Chapter 12. Saxon Socks. To post ourselves to Cambridge Town, they boarded the 1:30 Wednesday coach. Due to the level black plague warnings, they had the coach to themselves. During the journey, the 23-year-old Isaac Newton took time out from his ruminations to astound his new companion with, "So, Sean Saulpierre, where in your opinion did lie Galileo's chances in the Cannonball Derby?" Sean agaped his face appropriately. "How did you..." Newton smiled. "As elementary, my dear Master Saulpierre, as Mercury. My ambition is one day to be a great detective. I envisage myself stalking the underworld of the Docklands in London, hunting down criminals. So what else do you know about me?" "Oh, I'm completely in the dark," said Newton unconvincingly, and took the digital watch out of a frayed pocket of his coat, stained variously and chemically. "So much so, in fact, that I can deduce nothing at all, except the blindingly obvious. For example, that you are a time traveller, that you have fallen with this timepiece from the Tower of Pisa, helped Signor Galilei in his researches, and that you were the famed apprentice of Archimedes, quotationed in the John the Measurer texts, the so-be-called watchbearer of Syracuse. When I found the watch, it had been affixed to an apple. A coin acting as a lever had been posited ingeniously against one of these knobbies, so that upon impact it would be the causative action of the cessation of the time interval count progression. See here, this attachment band. Some strange animal skin. Plastic. What sort of animal is that?" "It's not an animal. It is manufactured artificially." "What from?" "Mineral oil." "And that would be?" "Remains of long-dead plants and animals." With an involuntary cry, Newton threw the watch down on the coach seat hurriedly and wiped his long fingers on his coat sleeves. How totally revolting. At least we use fresh corpses for our desecrations. "But how did you know it had to be the Leaning Tower of Pisa?" "Handrails. Italians never put handrails. Also, it is the only tower of exactly that height in Christendom, that is to say, the known world." "And Galileo Galilei?" "Well, the date on the coin, of course, helps. But who else would be eccentric enough to do such a thing? The fact that the timepiece is strapped to an apple implies it needed to be in free flight, but suffering minimal impedimency from the combined action of the ether and the air, and the Descartes vortexes that inhabit them. Knowing you are a time traveller, that must mean you were testing a theory for Galilei." Sean thought this over in amazement for a while. "And my being the apprentice of Archimedes, how did you deduce that?" "I think I shall let my master, Isaac Barrow, tell you that in person, for here we are arrived." The coach had been passing through the narrow streets of a half-deserted Cambridge, and now stopped in the half-flooded courtyard of Trinity College. The coach driver called down through the various aqueous consistencies, "Next stop, Trinity College. Alight ye masters of light and learning." On exiting, Sean immediately fell flat on his face in the mud. "Oh, and mind ye the gap," called the driver as he courteously dropped their trunks into the smaller of the puddles. They traipsed up the welcome carpet of mud-vectored slime to enter a plague-depleted but otherwise grand hall of Trinity College. And there, looking disapprovingly at the coffee-coloured lakes forming beneath them, was a sorry-looking professor senior to Newton by a fifth of 80 years. Newton did the introductions. "Sean Saulpierre, this is the honourable enough Lucasian professor of mathematics, and well-known scourge of the Eastern Mediterranean pirates, Isaac Barrow. We students just call him the Wheel. Entirely appropriate as a moniker, if you know his lectures. Round and round on the same point, like an ideal Keplerian orbit." Barrow shrugged indifferently. "Main way for to keep the students from attending." "Hold your hedgehogs, Professor. Sean is a master of the new e-drop slang."
"He speaketh the e-drop?"
"It is all I speak," admitted Sean.
"In veritas. My, my, young people these days."
Barrow scrutinized Sean.
"So, this is Sean Saulpierre. He has arrived at long last."
"You know me?" said Sean, surprised.
"Generations of scholars, as I have kept vigil, waiting in eager patience for you through the long ages. What took you so long? Still, I suppose it is an honour. Welcome to Cambridge, Sean Saulpierre, the Time Rider, the legendary bearer of the Sangreal, who appeared to Archimedes and who is recorded in the Measurer texts. He did a sort of theatrical bow. What are the Measurer texts? Asked Sean in wonderment. A collection of comedies for the Rosetta Theatre Festival of -212 that were collated and bound together in a single book. It is known as the Swan Song Palimpsest, because it also contains Archimedes' last notebook on Spiki Celesti and a user's guide to the Sangreal. Have you seen this Swan Song Palimpsest? Begged Sean. Yes, in Constantinople, during his pirate days, teased Newton. Oh, Sackett, that was a long time ago. You see, Sean Saulpierre, I was adventurous in my youth, much like you, seeking the knowledge of the East. I'm afraid it has made my reputation rather hard to live up to, or with. The wheel turneth full circle, as we say in Euclidonomics class, said Newton. As they walked through the magnificent and very woody corridors towards the dining hall, Barrow asked Newton, Do you have the Watsit? Not Watsit, watch. How many times do I have to tell you? Yes. Newton dug his hand into his pocket, brought out the watch, and a handful of plague posies fell out with it. He handed the venerated instrument to his mentor gingerly in a kerchief, avoiding at all costs skin contact with the strap. He went slightly green when Barrow took it with his bare hands. The professor studied it for a short while, then turned it over, read the inscription, and nodded. So, this is the Sangreal, sought mercilessly by every ruler of the Roman Empire, pharaohs, kings, emperors of Egypt, Persia, India, China, the cause of countless wars and igniting legends by the dozen, lost for 1600 years, hunted by popes and their payroll hench cardinals who wish to destroy it and the knowledge it contains. And now, here it is, the Holy Grail. Barrow tossed it carelessly back to Newton, who, to his horror, found himself catching it instinctively by the strap. Quite an anticlimax after all the fuss. With a cry of disgust and dismay, Newton flung the Holy Grail back into the air, stood aside briskly, and threw up into his wig. It's good to see university life was always like this, thought Sean to himself as he fielded the watch. For dinner, Isaac Barrow put on his best pirate costume in Sean's honour. After they'd been served in the otherwise empty grand dining room, Barrow said to Newton, Thank you for finishing my mathematics paper for me. My pleasure. But thank you for nothing, as usual. Sorry, Professor. Was something not right? The way Newton said this made Sean think this was not the first conversation of this type the Isaacs, Barrow and Newton, had ever had. What is this attraction gravity has for you, Saki? Gravity, 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 so serious. It's really getting me down. Nobody will fall for it. Sean did. And it hurt, added Sean. Isaac Barrow continued. I mean, honestly, what in the name of all that hangs was all that absurd stuff about an invisible force acting over a distance? Haven't we agreed, as to all the invisible college, that occult agencies haveth no place in science? He rolled his eyes beneath the rim of his heavily beplumed pirate hat. It's so chapeau vieux. Honestly, Saki, you are only 23, but sometimes you act like someone of the Middle Ages. I'm sorry, said Sean. What is this invisible force of which you speak? I don't want to hear this nonsense again. And the pirate, Captain Sack Barrow, covered his ears with his fakely bejeweled fingers and began humming to himself loudly. Newton smiled fondly at his professor and said to Sean, You see, I have this really strange idea that gravity is... Not listening, called Barrow, now staring at the chandelier. That gravity is, promise not to laugh, but, well, what if it were a force, and furthermore a force that, well, acts over distance? Sean waited a few moments, then said, And? Newton didn't like this. Didn't you hear what I said? I said a force acting over distance. Two bodies attracting each other without contact. Sean's lack of scandal was ruining everything. Barrow broke his vow of silence.
seeing the chance for an ally in Sean.
"Doesn't that seem like magic to you?"
Sean replied, "Not really. Gravity is one of the four fundamental forces of the universe."
"Fundamental forces?"
scandalized Barrow back at him, feeling surrounded by lunatics. "You see, the moon is like a heavy ball on the end of a string you whirl around your head." Sean illustrated his treatise with a finger twirl, and now wondered why this hadn't seemed so silly in physics class.
"But who does the whirling, Mr. Biggie? It would seem to me that he has better things to do than stand, or hover, or whatever, around all day whirling objects about our heads."
Sean desperately cross-referenced. "The universe is imbued with original spin, and bodies attract each other across space."
"Or a room?"
Barrow looked up from his jellied sparrow and mushy crabgrass.
"Now that is sexy. Bodies attracting across a room.
I have felt that attractive force across dance floors many a time. The greatest force in nature. Now that I see a practical application, I'm prepared to back the theory. There's no pull like gravity. That will draw the crowds in for sure."
"Crowds?" puzzled Sean by way of return. "Didn't I say? We are entering the Big Gut Festival in London, as soon as we get the all clear from the plague wardens. Isaac Barrow and Isaac Newton were billed as the sects."
"What's the Big Gut Festival?"
Newton answered him.
"It is a vehicle to promote New World fried sliced potatoes, being sponsored by that Scottish clan, the MacDonalds. Since they lost the claim to the throne, they have gone totally multinational."
"If you want to make big money, you've got to go in for branding these days," added Barrow reflectively.
"Branding? In 1666? Sean surprised back.
"Sure. You think we're primitive or something?"
"No, of course not. I didn't mean that.
Mind you, the hot irons they use really hurt. Hell of a way to advertise."
Newton went on. "GUT, G-U-T, stands for Grand Unified Theory. Originally billed as the gut instinct, but now that we are going for the final theory that explains life, the universe, and sundry phenomena, it is being sold as the Big Gut Festival."
"The final theory that explains everything?"
"I know, I know. People think we have now reached the point where we know everything there is to know."
"Nonsense," said Barrow.
"Quite right," added Sean. "Absolutely." Newton sealed the agreement and continued picking his teeth with a hedgehog spine.
"Of course, there's still a lot to learn," iterated Sean.
Newton spat out the spine in irritation.
"Don't be silly.
Everything was already known by the ancients. Trouble is, the Romans wiped the slate clean, literally in the case of Archimedes, so they could relaunch the learning industry and snap up the patents on the rediscoveries. Leech the controversy was adopted by the church as the logo for their Dark Age knowledge stagnation racket." Barrow nodded. "But what really upset their monopoly were those pesky Arabs and Indians who weren't having any bull from Rome. Thanks to their safekeeping, the knowledge from the ancient Greeks literally scraped back under the church's noses on the palimpsests.
You see, their empire being stable only by virtue of constant expansion, the Romans had no concept of zero, maintaining that a nothing cannot be a something. But some entrepreneurial Arabs revived it from an old, expired Babylonian patent. Initially as a college student date juice binge dare, they added the zero to the numeral one, and discovered they had invented a novel way to make 10. Then, under carefully controlled laboratory conditions, they added another zero. After many attempts, they finally made one that remained stable, and the world's very first fully functional digital 100 came to light. They refined their production technique, and in time, an entire rational number system was formed."
"And this was adopted everywhere?" asked Sean.
"You must be kidding. The church immediately slammed self-protectionist trade barriers on it. You see, since it made calculations easy, thus exposing their bookkeeping techniques to public accountability, the church called it the devil's numbers and banned it. This situation held back European mathematics for centuries, until along came Leonardo," concluded Newton.
"Da Vinci?" Sean sat up.
Left a bit.
"Sorry?" asked Sean.
"Not Vinci, Pisa.
His name was Bonacci, or more completely, Phileas Bonacci, son of Bonacci," hyper-precised Newton.
"Oh," said Sean, "Fibonacci."
"Was that his stage name?" asked Barrow.
"It was through this Leonardo Bonacci that the decimal system was adopted in Europe," asked Sean. sometime back in the 13th century, wasn't it? Yes, just after the Sangreal was reputed to have returned to us with Marco Polo, said Newton. And with the Arabic numerals came algebra, went on Barrow, and modern mathematics had arrived in Europe at long last.
So, Isaacs, went on Sean, what inspired your big gut stage show? The older Isaac answered, my old gambling friend, René Descartes. You knew Descartes? Asked Sean in amazement. I knew René Descartes when I was a young man. He was a great one for the cards. René, I used to say, have you got Descartes? Then after a few tankards, he would say, don't try to cheat me, wheelie boy, cogito ergo sum. That's classical pidgin for I can think, so I can add up as well as the next man. Cogito ergo sum, he would scream when he was drunk and winning, and dance on the tables in the tavern until we dragged him down. We just called him René of the Cards. He was sharp. Who needs philosopher's stone when he can have a stone philosopher?
And what did Descartes tell you? Prompted Sean.
He said that a too little underrated idea is the presence of Mr. Biggie in every universal pie.
The Archimedean pie? Asked Sean.
The same.
Newton leaned forward, suddenly sharp-eyed, all a-twinkly.
Sean, is the earth round or flat?
Well, everybody by now knows it is round.
Then tell me, if the earth has a round surface, why, when you droppeth a spherical marble, doth it not roll away?
I asked your tall friend, the one with the lovely lady friend.
Pow? Yes. And what did he say?
He did saith it was because of the inherent stickiness of all things.
That's Pow. And the real answer?
That, my little friend, is the essence of my very own grandly unified theory.
And what is that? Asked Sean.
Purely to make the competition harder, the gut organizers decreed that you may not delete Mr. Biggie from the equations.
Which is fair enough, put in Barrow. You see, they have some pretty onerous sponsorship issues to contend with.
Newton continued. The long-reigning champion, Ptolemy's mega-wheelie theory, had a fixed central Earth and described the motions of planets around it by an impressively complex machine involving wheels within, believe it or not, even more bleeding wheels.
I think the judges always voted for it because they didn't want to admit they couldn't understand it, laughed Barrow. I know I can't.
Newton pushed on. Ptolemy's run of success was finally broken by late entry in 1543. In fact, it was quite a deathbed effort by a Polish contestant, Nicolaus Copernicus. He was nicknamed by the press as the heliocentric hellboy because he put the sun at the center of the solar system. He passed the title to the tag team, Galileo and Johannes Kepler. But, going for a solo career, Galileo lost it in a tiebreaker match in the Roman festival of 1633 to some really dubious tactics and an ongoing controversy concerning the impartiality of the judges. Barrow nodded his head sadly. Galileo's proposal was rejected on the grounds that Mr. Biggie determined the result according to his whim, or, in the case of non-showing, his self-appointed representative. Newton went on. Now, this year's Big Gut Festival is being held in London, and it is to debate once and for all what sort of glue Mr. Biggie uses to put the universe together, said Newton with hints of gravity.
The Puritan entry says that it is held together by seriousness, added Barrow. Gravity would be a name they could live with. However, times have changed, Saki. Galileo was right. The world moves on. Today the Restoration Theatre crowd only want naughty comedy. Just think, we now have women on the stage.
Barrow's large wobbly hat developed an interesting resonance as he got excited.
Real women on the stage! Gads, the mind boogles!
Boggles?
Mind boogles.
Newton wrought them back on track briefly. But our toughest competitor is a military entry. You see, there is the question of what would happen on a round Earth if, as it seems to be the case, we keep building more and more powerful artillery cannons. Your experience with cannonball races will be of utmost utility to me in this, Sean.
Fire away, said Sean.
I ask this. Would a cannonball, given sufficient propulsion, describe a full circumvention of a spherical planet without ever landing? Newton illustrated his point by bouncing an apple off Barrow's still wobbling hat. Sean thought of Hieronymus and the neat parabolic curve he had described during his capital flight. You mean enter orbit? And if it were to do so, would that mean that a cannonball would eventually return to strike those who fired it in the back, thus destroying any army and making war impossible? That is why the army have put in a team for the festival, pushing for a return to the flat earth. Sean rallied his thinking. So, what is the plot of your show?
I found a brochure for the play stuck between the pages of the Archimedes palimpsest, said Isaac Barrow. You will find the story most interesting. Its climax is the burning of Syracuse by the Romans. It talks of a certain bearer of the watch, who brought Spici Celesti, the language of the gods, to Archimedes in the form of a celestial dial.
Legend has it that there are some hard copies of the original publicity posters still standing in Rosetta.
Carved on porphyry? Asked Sean, remembering John the Measurer chiseling a copy of Archimedes' notebook. And what happened to Archimedes' palimpsest? It was exchanged with an eastern goat herder for an order of cheese and yogurt just before the Roman invasion of Egypt.
That was cheap.
It was good cheese.
Did the Romans come looking for it?
Barrow sipped some more fermented squirrel juice before answering. Yes, but it was kept safe from Rome, and eventually was filed in the Mar Saba Monastery near Jerusalem, until it was liberated by a crusade remake in the 1100s. Not knowing what it was, the crusaders took it to Constantinople, where it was recycled and scraped over, cut up and the pages turned around. And if that weren't enough, some really boring liturgical hits were downloaded onto it by a heavy hand. That's how I found it. I could just make out Archimedes' writing. Parchment never loses all of its imprint.
You found Archimedes' notebook? Sean could barely contain his excitement.
Yes, I did, in a library. I couldn't take it out. My library card had expired, so I transcribed what I could.
Good, cried Sean, grinning with pleasure.
But I lost my notes. Sorry about that. But it wasn't just carelessness, as it would normally have been, just bad luck. You see, on the way home, I stopped off in Venice for a quick paddle, and a fire in my hotel destroyed my notebook. At least I couldn't find it afterwards.
Couldn't even find the hotel, commented Newton.